This is JS Party, your weekly celebration of JavaScript and the web. Are you missing out on the Changelog newsletter? Every Monday, I curate, contextualize, package up, and email you the developer news worth your attention. It's a totally free way to keep up with the fast pace of the software world the easy way. Sign up today at changelog.com/news. Big thanks to our partners, Fastly.com, Fly.io, and TypeSense.org. Okay, hey, it's party time, y'all.
What's up, friends? I'm here with James Cowling, co-founder and CTO at Convex. They're one of our new sponsors, and they're building a full-stack platform for the TypeScript era. So, James, in your main navigation, you link to a page called Convex versus Firebase. How similar is Convex to Firebase? And if someone is quickly trying to grok what Convex is that a good comparison?
I think it's a good starting point for sure. I mean, Firebase has been very impactful. And the people we speak to who use Firebase often love it, and they often lament the time they have to move off of Firebase because it's kind of failed to meet their needs as a growing company. So Firebase falls short in a few ways. One is in terms of like a fully relational document model. One is in terms of having strong type system. One is in terms of having this full end-to-end consistency story where you write functions that run on an API server on the data that you can subscribe to. And so one thing I think we see in the Firebase style development model is that you have web applications talking directly to a database in a cloud Firestore. With Convex, what is different is you have your code talking to actual fully fledged TypeScript functions running on your data that you can subscribe to. But I think the Firebase's comparison is fairly apt. And if someone is a Firebase user, I think you will love Convex. And it's certainly designed to fill that niche in the market. It's people who want to build applications without having to mess with infrastructure.
In what way has infrastructure failed specifically application developers?
I think if one was to compare what it looked like to build an application 10 plus years ago to today, it's gotten more complex, not less complex. There's a bewildering amount of frameworks. I think Google, for all their amazing work they do, has had a bad influence on how people build systems, because oftentimes when someone wants to build a web app these days, they're told to like learn Kubernetes or something ridiculous like that. You know, these infrastructure platforms really resemble the shape of the underlying implementation, not the shape of the problem that the application developer's facing. And so even when before we started Convex, we're talking to customers, people were like, well, I just want someone to like manage my Kafka cluster. And I say, well, why do you even have Kafka? And like, well, I don't really know. I think the database falls over if I don't put a queue in front of it, or like I need to like buffer some data somewhere. And what became clear is that the tools just weren't serving the needs of the application developers. And I think application developers and front-end framework engineers understand the problem space because they spend all day doing it. They sometimes don't have the power to fix the problem because they don't build the database themselves. And I think oftentimes infra folks, you know, and including myself, don't have enough empathy for the application developer. That at the end of the day, all that matters is the application.
Okay, if you're looking for a better type of backend, Convex is the full-stack TypeScript development platform you've been looking for. Replace your database, server functions, and glue code. Get started at convex.dev. That's convex.dev. Again, convex.dev.
Hello, JS Party listeners. So excited about today's show. With me today is none other than Chris. Hello, Chris. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi. So I know it's like Chris is very monotone, but he's really excited about today's topic because it's about JavaScript security. And with us today is a very special guest, a former colleague of mine, Ron Paris. Welcome. Hello, Ron. Welcome to JS Party.
Hello.
Hello. Yeah, so Ron, I don't want to butcher your intro, so why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Oh, sure. Yeah, so I've been working on some aspect of software for the last 20 years. Most recently, I'm at Reddit, and I'm an engineer there, and I'm focusing on code security.
Very cool. That's, very tight intro. I'll do the extended version, I guess.
Well, I could tell you a little more about it, what got me here. I mean, if that's interesting to people.
Yes, yeah, by all means.
Yeah, I think it's been kind of an interesting road. I first got a job writing software, I don't want to date myself too much, but in the late 90s. And back then, the developer, just like now, was mostly responsible for the security of their code. The organization I worked in didn't have like a dedicated security team that was going to do any review. So the code I wrote, and whether I made security mistakes or not, that's like kind of whether or not the code was going to be secure was kind of hinging on that. So I ended up diving into that aspect in the software we were writing at the time. And I found in that a product that I could kind of roll out. And I started a small company with a friend and we built a software security company. This is like early 2000s. And that got acquired by a Swedish company. And I went and was the CTO of a kind of a large Swedish computer security company called Outpost 24 for 6 years. And led product development there, worked with the software engineering function. Yeah, so, I mean, that was an interesting journey, but all of that ended around, 10 years ago, back in 2012. And I started looking at, what was I going to do next? And there was JavaScript had just recently kind of been through some changes. We had used ext.js on the front end of the application we were building at that startup. And so I was interested to see where JavaScript was going. And I started writing JavaScript code primarily and started working with Node.js a lot more. And then through that work, I bumped into kind of I don't think anybody could avoid it around this time, 2015, the learn to code movement of like, hey, let's get everybody coding. I kind of ran into like that crowd of like, hey, we have code schools and code camps and code workshops on the weekend. And like my experience up to that point, having been in the industry already for like over 10 years, was that it's kind of like surfing, people knew about it and like you could do it, but like not everybody was interested. You didn't see like throgs of people on the beach just like dying to get in the water. It's just like people were, wanted to code, they learned or didn't. There were books, there was things, but I saw that like there was a huge demand suddenly. It was like everybody wanted to learn to surf. And there was a lot of people in my local area because this thing was kind of localized, these code schools were kind of like in your region. They weren't like, oh, everybody went to San Francisco or you could do it online at that point. And so because it was regional, I felt like, well, wouldn't it be cool to like, as a lifestyle business or something, run one of these code schools while my kids are small and, really teach a few people like software engineering from my perspective since I've been doing it for a while. So I ended up starting a code school. I ended up scaling it up a little bit to a few instructors, taught, almost 200 people how to code, helped them get jobs, and learned a ton of JavaScript in the process, learned a ton about like where all the pitfalls are and like where all the problem space is that people have with like learning how to do it correctly. And out of that, I kind of got myself into a weird space, which is like I was one of the few people that I knew of in my social circle that had spent time thinking about like modern JavaScript and had thought about secure coding and had like thought about, how do you teach somebody? And so one of my friends tapped me from like more in the security industry friend tapped me and said, hey, a lot of people are writing modern JavaScript, but they don't know what the like proper patterns are for frameworks like React. They're not sure how to get it right. Would you mind sitting down and just like writing out a list of like back in 2018, like just a list of things that people should be aware of if like they're writing code in React so they don't make mistakes like cross-site scripting? And I thought maybe it was like, hey, I don't know if there's really much to write. It might just be like a really short blog article. He wanted me to do it as kind of like a full-fledged course that was going to be taught to like in a corporate setting. And so I took that project on and I spent, 40 or 50 hours of research to try to figure out like, hey, what exactly is the attack surface of a React application? And like, where's the API that developers are expected to use in order to stay on the secure path? And like, where can they potentially like pull an escape hatch and kind of pop out of the intended React security model? And I think you, Momal, had mentioned you might've bumped into like one of the outcroppings of that work, which was a cheat sheet that was floating around that I helped author.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a hot cheat sheet that we'll link in the show notes. It's hot. Yes, I think it's hot. It's 10 React security best practices. So it's solid, but also just in general, like you're kind of just humble. You're very humble. And like, I'm going to like fill in your bio and your background a little bit. But yeah, no, you do a lot of work with community and especially in the security space. And I've always kind of thought of you as this person that's bridged the security world and the infosec. I don't even know. Am I using the right? Is it infosec? I don't even know. There's something sec, appsec. Maybe is it appsec? I don't know. Something sec world What's the acronym that I'm looking for?
So I think well, the reason that I might be put in that application security or product security space is that I built some products that lived in that space. So like that original product that I built, where I was doing the, you know, software engineering aspect for a product that was a software service product around security. At the time, you know, like a team of application security people might use that product, or like an InfoSec team might use that product. So I think that's how I ended up understanding that world. And then another thing I did is there's a community organization out there called OWASP, which is the Open Web Application Security Project. And they had local chapters, and they had this cool mantra of rough consensus and running code is how they run their organization. And they let anyone just start like independent chapters. And so I started one. I joined one in Orange County, kind of rebooted one in Orange County that wasn't running at the time. And I ended up getting pretty involved in OWASP in the sense that I ended up helping to found one of the larger OWASP computer security conferences that was happening yearly for 6 or 7 years called APSEC California. And at that conference, we would bring together like builders, breakers, and defenders and have multiple tracks where we talked about various aspects of like getting it right when it comes to application security. So I think like there was a lot of interesting things there that happened, but that conference served its needs. And I also, from a community aspect, I guess, I was doing something interesting. I was looking around. This is like right before I joined NPM on their security team. I was looking around at some of the libraries that I used, and I was looking at like the code of some of these common libraries. And I was noticing like not every library was like perfectly written. Some of them contain like security mistakes of kind of a new variety, which is like, what if the library has something in it where when you use it, if you don't really know how it works underneath the hood, you could potentially like add a security bug to your application. But if you know how to use a library correctly, you wouldn't add that bug. These are like some of the harder ones to deal with from a security bug perspective, because up to that point, developers, like especially bug bounty style, like developer reporting of bugs, you basically would go and say like, hey, you have this running application sitting on a website, like, I don't know, stripe.com or whatever. And like, I can show that like I can exploit the bug by sending some input and measuring some response. When it comes to like a library bug, there's this whole like debate where you're like, hey, you know, you have this library and I could see that most users, if they use it in the normal way, would inadvertently add this security bug to their application. And then the developer who maintains that library might say like, you know, hey, you're holding it wrong, you know, kind of a Steve Jobs moment where, hey, you're calling my library incorrectly, or you're passing the wrong set of arguments. And so you end up in this like nuanced debate of like, well, shouldn't the way that's like everyone uses it be the secure way? Shouldn't there be some secure default idea here where if I just use it, like, for example, I want to pop up some kind of modal dialogue on the screen, and you have some kind of parameter called text. And when I put HTML in there, my expectation is that would go into text content, not into inner HTML. But maybe under the hood, this library maintainer, for whatever reason, takes your text and puts it into inner HTML every time. And so you end up in this kind of like nuanced debate with them of, hey, should we fix that? Is that a problem? And they might say like, no, it's not a problem. You just need to know more about how my library works. And so I spent time in the Node.js ecosystem security work group looking through all of these types of bugs and working with maintainers to try to get them fixed. And that was like another community thing that I worked on.
Yeah, no, that was dope. And that was kind of around the time that I learned about you as a person because we worked together at the same company. And funny enough, Ron and I were both there when NPM was going through its GitHub hack. And Ron was like, joined a team that I was leading to like help tackle a lot of the due diligence kind of security bugs, you know, that the white hat hackers found, right? So that's pretty typical that companies, you know, they'll do their due diligence to try and they'll hire people to look and see how secure your code is. And they want to make sure that you fix and take care of those liabilities before they acquire you because they don't want to take on that liability, right? And so Ron, I got to see Ron at work basically like in that space. And it was so fascinating to see like how good you were at your job, Ron. Like you're really good. Like you're like incredibly fast at like diagnosing and finding issues. And then when like I like peeled back the onion a little bit and I was like, who is this Ron Paris? And I was like, oh, okay, he's so good because he's like Donald, he like teaches JavaScript courses, he's like does all this community work. I felt like you had so many different like perspectives to bring to the table. And, you know, so I just, yeah, you're awesome. You're awesome to work with. And so
you must have, I just must have had like a couple good days, because I don't know. Those are true things about me, but I appreciate it.
I don't know. But no, so incredible background. And so you kind of talked a little bit about the Node.js security working group. Can you tell us a little bit about like what that is and all that jazz?
Yeah, I didn't really know what it was. I sort of stumbled into it. I had found a security bug in a URL parser. And I know what you're thinking. You're like, doesn't Node have a built-in URL parser? Like, why would there be a library that parses URLs? Well, because the NPM ecosystem at the time, there was a library that like had millions and millions of downloads that did kind of the same thing as like the built-in URL parser. And that was because for historic reasons, like that URL parser wasn't ideal. And I think you even worked on some of the, you had mentioned, I think the spec there had recently been updated, or Node had recently updated like their implementation towards the spec. So like, I guess there was some gap in like what the market wanted and what Node was offering. So there was some kind of URL parsing library with millions of downloads. And I noticed that like when it was to parse URLs, in some cases, it like, you could give it some kind of input and then it wouldn't do like proper validation. And then instead it would like reflect something in the output and it would tell you something about the URL that wasn't true. Like it would tell you like, oh, this URL is like an HTTP URL. And when you asked like the returned object property, it would be like, oh, it's a HTTP. But in fact, underneath the hood, it was a JavaScript URL. And for those of you who know, like if you take a JavaScript protocol URL and you put it on a web page, it's going to act quite differently than just an HTTP or HTTPS URL. Because that JavaScript URL can execute code in the context of the current page. So I found this vulnerability and I thought, oh, this is something we should get fixed. And I started looking for a place to like kind of give it to so I didn't have to follow up on it. And that's when I bumped in the Node Security Ecosystem Work Group, which I think at the time, you know, had a few members, some from IBM, some from other places. And I said, hey, do you guys take like reports like this? Do you like take a report on something in the ecosystem and run it down and get it fixed? And they had like a HackerOne page that was public at the time. And I thought, okay, this is a good place to report it. And then I reported it and then the page got closed down and the program got paused. And I was like, wait, what is this thing? Why is it stopping? So I kind of dug in. I was like, why did you guys stop taking reports? And they're like, hey, you got no idea, man. Like we are taking reports for the whole ecosystem. So like anybody finds a bug in anything, they can just report it via our HackerOne program. And like we have a limited amount of people that could do triage and go in and look at these and figure out if they're valid and work with maintainers to get them fixed. So that's when I decided like, oh, I should help here. And I joined the work group and I started trying to tackle the backlog myself and, you know, triage not just my own vulnerability that I reported, but, you know, went on to triage a lot more vulnerabilities reported by others. I think that working group served a purpose for a long time. I think eventually those reports got funneled to Sneak directly. I think Sneak was a big part of that working group. So they decided, hey, why don't you just report them to us? Because we have a vested interest in like triaging them and making them into CVEs and putting them in our tool and having people become aware of them. I don't know. I don't have a lot to say about all that, but I think that like, yeah, like the Node.js Foundation work group was pretty cool at the time. It's now not there from what I can tell. And there was an attempt to restart it elsewhere, but I don't know. I mean, it's a hard problem, right? Like whose responsibility is it? If there's a vulnerability in some library in the ecosystem, some people would say it's the maintainer. I think like Node in general as a community has a vested interest in like those types of things being followed up on and having people look into them and figure out like if they're valid and then like drive them towards remediation. Because as you know, a lot of libraries that are like heavily used might not be like actively maintained.
And so to be clear, this is a different working group than the Node Security Working Group.
Right. This is the ecosystem working group. So Node Security Working Group is like, oh, we found a bug in Node.
Right.
And like, there's actually like some problem with something. And then we're going to create a release of Node. This is like, there's an ecosystem. And so the charter, I think, scoped like all packages within the Node.js ecosystem. And there was, I think, an attempt to like take some responsibility there. There was a later attempt, you know, I think, by others that has continued where people are trying to scope that down to just like some important core libraries and say like, oh yeah, like for this small subset of open source packages, like we'll continue to care about them and like drive remediation for issues. But like, we're not going to take on the whole ecosystem.
Right. That was an effort at IBM when I was there. There was like these, I don't remember what we called them, but it was a list of like popular core modules that they wanted to, I don't know, just apply some resources to for security and critical fixes and things.
Yeah, it's like the 80-20 rule, like, you know, protect these popular packages and, you know, you cover a wide base of your surface. So first of all, like, Ron, that was like a lot you just shared, lots to unpack. Like, let's roll back a little bit. So first of all, whoa, I, like, in my silliness, didn't even realize that there was a difference between the Node ecosystem security working group and the Node.js like security working group. Like, I just assumed that those were the same thing. So thank you for clarifying that, Chris and Ron. And it's like really sad to hear that the ecosystem security working group isn't really a thing anymore, but I completely understand why. That's a massive undertask, like, to take on. I remember, like, when I was at NPM, just being so impressed by the security team, like, what a small and mighty team, and just like the, like, such few people managing to kind of protect such a huge, massive ecosystem, like all the, like, malware detection and all of that, like, stuff just worked. It was like very impressive in that regard.
I think a lot of that was Adam and Adam Baldwin and his background, and he had a deep understanding of so many aspects of security related to the Node.js ecosystem. I joined that team in an interesting way. I was running a conference dedicated to product security, which I could talk a little bit more about later, but I was running that conference and Adam came out as a speaker and spoke on the topic of NPM security. And this was like a super hot topic at the time. And I was doing the work in the Node.js work group and I had an interest there, but I wasn't necessarily like looking to start working somewhere like NPM. But after talking with Adam and like he kind of explained the problem space, and there's, you know, everything from like malware being served by the registry to the packages themselves and their security to doing some instrumentation and try to figure out like, is there some behavioral patterns we can look at for how the packages act when they're being, you know, installed versus how they acted last time? There was just so many interesting kind of product security slash, you know, threat landscape detection, just interesting problems there that Adam seemed to really have his head wrapped around. And so I joined that team. And like you said, it was a small team and we were, you know,
very mighty though.
Yeah. We had some people behind the NPM audit tool, which however you feel about that, I think that was a lot for the team. You know, it was a small team to write those advisories and keep them up to date and try to manage that functionality in the tool that was in front of so many developers. Yeah, it was a lot, but I think you've talked about it a few times on this podcast, but we were all really excited at NPM. You know, we all had our little space and we were all doing really fun stuff, but I don't think any of us feel like we had enough time, you know, to really get to do the things we wanted to do while we were there. Yeah, so I think like you mentioned, I was on the security team and then the acquirer said, hey, there's a list of vulns you need to fix. And then I joined your team, and that was a lot of fun to go around and try to fix some of those those vulnerabilities. But I think it's interesting to see that some of your guests are now talking about problems that Adam was aware of even back then. You know, kind of when I joined the team, he had mentioned things like this recent, you know, manifest confusion. Maybe it wasn't the exact same thing that Darcy's explaining, but something similar to the fact that, like,
oh yeah,
you're auditing one thing, but you're serving something else to the user. And you know, some of these other problems that now you're seeing, like, tools get built for and other companies are building around this solution space. I think very early on, you know, it's crazy to think that like just a few of us were trying to tackle any of that at NPM.
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely. No, I mean, it's, I feel like that's like a show on its own, right? It's like
with Adam, yeah.
with Adam. Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to get him to come on the show for a while. He's just, you know, he's Adam.
Yeah.
You know, Adam.
I think he's in the Pacific Northwest somewhere.
Yeah.
Based on Twitter, like raising chickens or something.
That's so cool. That's so cool. I'll have to try again. It's been a few years since I've tried.
Friends, I'm here with Eldad Fuchs, founder and CEO of AppRite. Build fast, scale big, all in one place. Eldad, what's the backstory on your platform?
The main thing is basically I started AppRite for myself. It started as a side project about 3 years ago when I was trying to solve my own challenges as an engineer. I'm coming with a background. I've been writing code for something like 20 years. And I've been building a lot of solo projects and I've been leading teams as a team lead, as a CTO. And I always felt like things are way more complex than what they should be. At some point, I also discovered that my true passion is not really just writing code. It's actually seeing stuff become coming to life. and code was just a mean to an end, and then was to build product. And Apple's goal was to basically try and abstract all of this complexity, all of this knowledge that you needed to possess as a developer about security, building different APIs. You know, for me, it took, in one of my previous companies, it took us like 6 months to build an authentication API for a massive platform with over 1 million users. And that's something that, you know, honestly, I don't ever want to do again. Not just because it was so complex, like who wants to build the same thing twice? So Apple, it was this like platform that I imagined that like I can just build it once and let everyone build on top of it and build my own side projects on top of it, build my own startup on top of it, which actually my previous startup was built completely on top of Apple. Yeah, and today we have major services, major products that are just all inside the same platform. Like if you need authentication, Apple has it. If you need storage management, like manage your files and manage your image transformation, Apple has you covered. If you need a database to like store and make sure that you can handle all the persistency needs of your app, you got it. You need serverless functions, you got it. And we're planning a lot of more surprises down the road and add a lot more capabilities to this. What we envision is like the cloud that was designed, that is designed for developers.
Okay, the cloud that was built for developers, AppRite.io. Check them out. Build fast, scale big, all in one place. AppRite is a back-end platform for developing web, mobile, and Flutter applications. Get started at AppRite.io. Again, AppWrite.io. And tell them JS Party sent you.
Much to get into in this show today, y'all. Like, we're gonna see, like, you know, what we can cover in the next like 40-50 minutes. So what I really kind of want our listeners to kind of walk away with is just like a better understanding of, like, you know, what the hell is JavaScript security, right? Like, what does securing your application even mean from a broad sense? You know, what can you use tooling wise you know, what resources are available, etc. But more specifically as well, like, as you're using, you know, frameworks, you've taught a course in 2018, you taught a course that was specific to like React security. And I see that you're kind of updating that course to now using Lit, right? Like, which is cool. I'm like, yay, Lit HTML. Like, I love Lit. So can you, you know, for kind of your average developer, like where do they start, right? Like, where do you even get started with like understanding how to responsibly secure your code and your applications?
It's interesting, you know, I think I'm like a crossover artist here on this podcast because I've spent a lot of time in the security community and I'm obviously a developer, but I haven't spent a lot of time talking with developers on podcasts like this or at developer conferences. And I think that there's like a pretty big mismatch between the way that developers look at secure coding and the topic and the way that the security industry looks at it. So when it comes to the developers who are actually writing the code, they almost always get it right. You know, that's like almost all code that's out. What's that?
It's good to know. So people are sanitizing their inputs and doing all the things.
Well, think about it. I mean, you've got bug bounty programs out there, right? And if people weren't getting it right most of the time, then people would just be becoming millionaires all day reporting bugs for all this poorly written software. So you got to imagine that, like, at the end of the day, the stuff that's out there in production is, for the most part, written in a way where it's not easily exploitable. And, you know, for like the kind of companies that we might end up working for, that'll probably continue to be the case. So I think that you got to be fair to the development community and say that, like, they almost always get it right. You know, 99.9% of the time, the code they write is secure. So they know the patterns. You know, they don't need me to come on a podcast and like tell them, because like they do it all the time. I think where it gets nuanced is when you're talking about like moving between frameworks or moving to new frameworks or new tools. I think there's a moment where people aren't sure what like the recommended best practice is. And the hope is that the library maintainer or the developer of the framework has already thought that through for them so that it's easy for them to kind of stay on like the, whatever you want to call it, the paved path.
Golden path.
Yeah, sure. Smooth path. I've heard. Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of paths. Mm-hmm. Slippery path. Like in the React community, when they originally built that framework, I think one of the biggest contributions was the naming of that prop, right? They called it like something extreme, right? What is it called?
Oh, I have a song about this.
Dangerously set inner HTML. What's so dangerous about HTML's inner parts? I don't know. But they're dangerous. on the internet of React. React's internet, of course.
Right. So like that was like really cool because that became something that the security community could talk a lot about, where they could say like, oh yeah, and watch out for React. And like, you got to make sure you don't use dangerously set in our HTML. When I went and looked into React and tried to figure out like how would you make mistakes and looked at the code that other that our team had written at NPM and other teams had written, I noticed that like dangerously set in our HTML usage is something that every single application has. So it's not like people can avoid it. It's you're going to end up using it. I guess the hope is just like when you're using it, just like when you're using inner HTML, you're just not going to make a mistake. And instead, you're going to in some way like guarantee that the stuff you're putting in there doesn't contain attacker-controlled scripts. I say that in a very specific way for a reason. It's like, you know, there's a lot of lore about how you're supposed to do secure coding. So for example, like maybe somebody says like, oh, you got to sanitize all your inputs, you know? Like get those inputs and sanitize them or validate them.
That's me.
It's like, okay.
That's me. That's what I say.
Yeah, yeah. Sanitize and validate those inputs, you know? But that's not always the control you want. It's not always possible to do it in that way. When it turns out when it comes to cross-site scripting in particular, what you're really looking for is contextual output encoding. Because what you're trying to do is you're trying to say at the time where I'm going to take the attacker control value and do the dangerous thing with it, I want the result to be like treated as benign. And so you want some benign equivalent characters, right? Like HTML encoded characters on the screen. That's if you're having to put it in a context where it could be treated as code. If you were to say like, oh yeah, I just want to get this on the page, you should do something where you prefer an API like text content over in our HTML so that it's like really not even possible to make that mistake because you didn't leave yourself open for it. I think dangerously set our HTML is like an equivalent of inner HTMLing something where you're like, hey, I have this dangerous value and like, I'm going to do something dangerous now and hopefully I get it right. You know, there is an alternative way to do this in React, but I've seen, you know, presentations by like React experts and they don't seem to necessarily know the exact pattern for getting it right when it comes to like user controlled or attacker controlled content and then getting it on the page successfully without using dangerously set our HTML. I don't know if you're interested in like the nuts and bolts of that, but I could talk a little about that.
Oh yeah. I mean, yeah, I would say dig in, dive in, please.
Okay. So like the way that the React library works is that it's willing to create elements on your behalf. And so when you're calling its APIs and you're passing props, those aren't just like directly getting concatenated and placed into their HTML on the page. What they're doing instead is like they're using underneath the hood the DOM's programmatic APIs to build those elements. So can if you imagine like the most simplest way, it's like, you know, running create element, running set attribute, running those types of APIs in order to create a DOM node tree that you can then put on the page at some point. And so I think that when you go and use, you know, something like dangerously set in our HTML, you're kind of like skipping your way out of that entire API. And a way for you to get back to the point where you're using that API to protect you is you'll see a few libraries out there that do this. So let's say like take an example, Markdown. A Markdown is a common situation where you have some Markdown and you want to put it on the page. And often what people will do is they'll render that Markdown into some kind of like string. And then they'll take that string and they'll put it in dangerously set in our HTML. There's libraries out there that go through a lot of steps in order to not to do that, in order to do it in a more secure way. So what they'll do is they'll actually take that Markdown content and then they'll create an abstract syntax tree out of that Markdown. And then they'll walk that abstract syntax tree looking for an allow list of elements and attribute types that are allowed to be in the rendered output. And then they'll use React's API to actually programmatically create each of those elements with those appropriate attribute types so that it ends up on the page, but it's rendered through the React rendering mechanism. And therefore, you get all the built-in guarantees of like React does stuff where it like makes sure you don't use dangerous types of attributes. It makes sure you only use an allow list of tags. Like there's all these security mechanisms in those rendering functions in React. So that in that way, it keeps you on like that paved path. I don't know that everybody knows that's happening if they use, you know, the React APIs, but that is what's happening underneath the hood.
Wow. No, that's fascinating. And I can imagine like with tools like Lit that use tag template literals and all kinds of other like string injection-y stuff. Like has that world like expanded for you? I don't know. Like is the security world?
Yeah.
I don't know. You tell me.
Yeah. So I joined Reddit a couple of years ago, and I don't know if everybody knows. My daughter doesn't know what Reddit is, so I don't know. If, I figure we all do in your audience because it's 18 years old, right? It's an old website that people used to use, and it's basically like threaded forums with comments with like up and down voting, is what you can imagine. Reddit, there's a version of it that's still online called old.reddit.com, and that's a very old application that uses Python with Jinja 2 templates, and it's doing like, you know, something to render content and serve it. You've got that still running out there, and then you've got everything from that to like a version that's built using Lit Element and using all these modern features. And then in between those two versions of Reddit, you've got a version built in React, you've got a version built using React Redux, which is like for mobile viewport. So for me, like as kind of like a JavaScript front-end security person, Reddit was a really interesting opportunity because there's like so many code bases that are all front ends that are all implementing Reddit. So, and you have our native clients, obviously. So I think that like, when I look at like the attack surface and what I worry about, I look at like, hey, we got these like this old thing, right? That's using Jinja templates and like, it's kind of battle hardened and tested, maybe by our users, maybe by bug bounty, but like, it's probably pretty good. And then we've got like these couple of React apps where, you know, I feel like I understand the attack surface. Like I've done some research, I published some information about it, and I feel comfortable looking at those code bases and recommending like, hey, here's like the secure path. More recently, we've started serving worldwide traffic through web components using Lit. So we're authoring code every day that's either written with native web components or it's written using Lit. And I can talk about kind of why we're doing both, because I think that's a little confusing. But you know, if you're using Lit, are you okay? I guess I heard one of your podcast guests, I think, talked about this and was like,
yeah, Justin Fignani. He was, yeah, he's like the author of Lit. He's
like, you're okay, right?
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, I don't know. I didn't specifically ask him that, but
I agree. Like,
I want to hear your thoughts.
Sure. No, I agree. Like, I'm not an expert on Lit, so let me just like disclaim that. I'm catching up. But as I come into it with a different, I'm not a developer in the sense that like, I'm not trying to ship a web component. I'm coming at it from like, what's the attack surface that we're providing to our developers? And how many things do they have to get right in order not to make a security mistake? And so I knew that with React, I could just say like, hey, like avoid like DOM mutation through refs. Hey, don't use dangerously set in HTML. Don't use server-side rendering and then concatenate things to the end of the output. Like I had these patterns. When it comes to Lit, I've been doing discovery over the last year and kind of trying to build in those security defaults into what we're doing. And I'll give you an example. Lit's API provides unsafe HTML, unsafe CSS, unsafe static, unsafe SVG, template content. That's not the complete list of escape hatches for ways to get outside of the protections that are being provided by the HTML function, which, you know, as you mentioned, uses tag template literal syntax. Just underneath the hood, you know that that's just like another way to call a function. So that's just a way to like line up its parameters and replace values. So I think that like, the protections that are being provided by Lit HTML are great. And if you know like where all the places are where you have to be careful, it's great. I like that the API names so many of the functions with like the preface unsafe. So you could get a linter, right? You could just run through your code base and say like, hey, lint for all these common function calls. And then like, let me know if I used them and like point me towards docs if I'm not supposed to. But I think there's some other surprising APIs.
Yeah, yeah. No, I 100% agree. And for what it's worth, I mean, like Lit came out of Google. You know, Google's very, very conscious of security. In fact, a lot of these unsafe functions are stripped out of the internal library that's used at Google. Because Lit's widely used there. So just, you know, I'm like, they don't even allow you to have the foot like escape hatch, right? Which yeah. I think is great. I wish more companies did that, where they just are like, nope, we're not even gonna like include this in our internal bundle, like not even happening, you know? But yeah, I mean, Lit obviously, like tag template literals are it's a web standard, right? So it's not like it's something that like Lit is inventing, and in that sense, like I feel like browser engineers really do think a lot about security when they're implementing web standards. And so, you know, in that sense, I do feel like, yeah, it's okay as well. doesn't mean like, you know, you can't do something dangerous. It just means like, I don't know, like I feel a lot more confident using it. But
I think going back to like the original assertion, which is like developers almost always get it right, then I think that developers will get it right almost always with Lit. And it's just a question of like, when you're switching from one framework to another, what are the things you got to like pay attention to, because you are going to end up in a scenario where you're going to want to put attacker controlled content on the page, like surprisingly often, like in the Markdown case or others. So I think, yeah, like knowing what those like escape hatches are and being able to identify them and configure your linters to catch them and just doing that basic security work is a good idea.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And so kind of, you know, what I'd like to do is to kind of focus on like front end greatest hits and then server side greatest hits, right? So because we can start with some of the best practices on the front end. So defaulting to use cross-site scripting protection when you're doing data binding. Can you kind of talk us through that?
Sure. Yeah, I think like probably your audience knows how to do this correctly, but it depends on what context you're in. I mean, if you're on the server, which in a lot of cases as JavaScript developers, we are these days, like where if we're writing like some server-side rendered React or we're doing server-side rendered lit at work, you know, you might be in a situation where you're able to take some attacker control content from a query, and then you're trying to build a page and you're trying not to make this mistake that I've been describing, where you're taking some attacker control content that contains scripts and putting it into a context where it can be executed as a script. So what you need to know is like, there's kind of like a source to sync mindset where you're like, I'm getting data from somewhere, like in a query, and then I'm going to use it somewhere, which is the sync, and that sync, there are a certain number of them that are potentially dangerous. So like inner HTML is a sync, outer HTML is a sync. There's a project, it's actually built into Chrome called Trusted Types that identifies what all the syncs are for dangerous information that could be rendered in the DOM. And it helps you like write a policy to protect against things being placed there. But so let's say you have this information and now you're going to put it somewhere dangerous. You have to know where you're putting it in order to know what protection to apply. So if you're putting it like in the content of an element, then you need to use like HTML entity escaping. If you're placing it in an attribute context, let's say like you've got an attribute, then you got the equal sign, then you've got like double quotes. If you allow double quotes in there, somebody will escape out of your double quotes and then continue to like put their page contents. So you have to, in that case, make sure that like all attributes are escaped. Frameworks will often take care of this for you. And then once you're inside of that context, then you need to go on further, say like, oh, I want to escape these values contextually for this usage. So I think the thing to remember when it comes to cross-site scripting is, first of all, apply like content security policy, because you're not going to get all this stuff right. So you probably want like a content security policy that's going to be another layer of protection. But then when it comes to like preventing someone from putting scripts on the page, you need to take a contextual approach and say like, well, where is this going to be used? So that's why I kind of made fun of earlier the idea that you could validate and sanitize the inputs to prevent cross-site scripting, because until you know where on the page it's going to be used and in what context, you don't know what exact encoding or technique you're going to need to use in order to avoid cross-site scripting.
It seems like that's a good opportunity for creating a vulnerability where you have this input that you thought you sanitized and you were displaying it one place and now you need to display it somewhere else. And you're like, oh, it's sanitized, so let's just put it out there. Yeah, we're fine. But it all depends on how you output it.
Yeah, totally. Like if you're kind of a code smell from a security team, is like if you look at values in a data store and you notice that they're like escaped and sanitized in there, then you know something's gone wrong with like your security mechanism. Because like you didn't, unless you were escaping them for SQL injection, which in that case, it shouldn't be noticeable because like they should have been inputted as a raw values. Yeah, if they're escaped for like HTML context and they're sitting in the database, then like you're applying that in the wrong place. You need to apply that control at the place where you're using the data in the dangerous way, where there's an interpreter present that could possibly treat that data as a script.
Yeah, that makes sense. Wow, I learned some things. So I mean, I was like, you know, I maybe obvious to you, security nerd, not obvious to me. Not security nerd. Okay, so I'm walking through your cheat sheet. So number two, watch out for dangerous URLs and URL-based script injection. We talked a little bit about this, but I'd love to dig in a bit more. So
sure, yeah. So this is the idea that at times you want to take from a user what's going to end up being a URL destination on the page. So you're saying like, hey, what is your social media profile? And then you're taking their actual full string of what their social media profile is, and you're letting them control that entire URL, and then you're placing it on the page in like the href attribute of an element. And if you do that, and they give you what starts with like JavaScript colon, which is a JavaScript protocol URL, then they can provide like some attacker-controlled script as a URL. So it'll say like JavaScript colon, you know, alert one or whatever, just so they can run something in the context of the page. And like what I've often seen, it's one of the areas in React applications where developers have to know the right thing to do. Every time as a React developer that you go to put an attacker controlled URL in an href, you have to check it yourself and make sure like, oh, wait, is this like an HTTP or HTTPS URL? Or like, is this a JavaScript URL? And if it's an HTTP or HTTPS URL, like I don't want to, I'm cool to put it on the page, but otherwise like I shouldn't put a JavaScript one on the page. And like, I've seen this vulnerability at every company I've worked at. So it's not uncommon that people make this mistake. And then I think React wanted to solve this. So they were like, wow, this is like a kind of a big hole. So they ended up building a warning in the developer console. So when this bug exists in your code base, you will see a warning in the developer console that says something about, hey, you're using JavaScript URLs and like their dynamic values and you might be introducing cross-site scripting.
It seems like it would need to be an allow list because there's so many URL, like each app has its own URL scheme now, especially on Apple devices, right? So, and you can...
Yeah, and you can see why I got really interested in like URL parsers for a while there 5 years ago. Because I'm like, okay, let's say you're building this security control where you're checking URLs and you're like, hey, what kind of protocol is this URL? Is it an HTTP or HTTPS URL? Well, like if your library has a flaw in it where it misidentifies what type of URL you're working with, then you could inadvertently like accept URLs that were in fact, you know, JavaScript URLs and you're thinking they're HTTP URLs. And that's a kind of a computer security, software security maxim, like axiom, which is like, you should use the same parser to make the security decision that you do to actually run the code. So like if you're using, I don't know, on the back end, URL parse is like some NPM library that you chose. Then on the front end, you're actually using like the browser's built-in URL parser. There's like, there's been research on that that shows, I think it was Orange Decide's research that like there's a, you know, difference between parsers and how they treat things. So like in that problem space, like you could easily introduce, you know, some kind of thing that like passed the validator, passed the parser, but then when it's actually used, it gets treated in a different way.
Yeah. I mean, for me, you're just highlighting one of the issues that I think I have first had when I was writing Node code. I know that rhymes. Try not to laugh. Node code. You think, oh, JavaScript. Oh, like you think URLs work the same like they do in the front end. You think parsing is the same. There's so many little gotchas where you like, it looks the same. It's like, but it's really not, you know, and these little different, like the little nuances that get you. And I think like that, those are things that I feel like there should be a book on, like, okay, you're writing JavaScript in the server now. Here's some things you need to know. Like here's a hat that you need to put on to like context switch appropriately. Like this is not the browser, you know, like fetch is not fetch, like a lot of things, you know?
Yeah.
So
we have a defense layer like that at, you know, that at work, it's an open source project. I think it just got archived, unfortunately. But like, here's another example.
We can still link it if it's an archived project.
Yeah, it's a really good project. It makes a lot of sense that they built it. What it is you're in this situation where you're running code on the back end and you've been provided with a URL and you're expected to use that URL to make a request. You don't want to make requests to internal resources. You only want to make requests to like an external resource. So for example, if someone's given you an image and you want to like, I don't know, grab it and like make a preview version of it or something. And so you're going to make a request from the back end, from some privileged service that's sitting in your microservice fleet, you're going to be making a request. And if you inadvertently make an internal request, you could like connect to like an internal database server, or you could connect to something else and maybe provide that data about whatever gets returned to the attacker. So I feel like you want to do something right there. You want to do the right thing. And that vulnerability is called server-side request forgery. And it's a really common vulnerability that people are facing because they don't know what to do in that circumstance. They've been provided with a URL, and then what do they do is at the time they receive it, they look up its DNS and they go, oh, okay, it comes back to a public IP address. Okay, now I'll store it in the database and I'll consider it a valid URL. Well, again, when you go to use it, at the time of use, DNS can change, right? DNS is not static. So like, it's that whole like time of check, time of use problem where now you're looking at a URL that resolves suddenly to an internal IP address, and then the attacker can use that. It's called a DNS rebinding attack to make a connection to that internal resource using that previously validated URL. So what you want to do instead is like use a library like Advocate in the Python community where it does all of that stuff under the hood. It protects itself from DNS rebinding. It does that validation. It'll accept like an allow list of, you know, URL components that are allowed within the request URL. And then it kind of does all that work for you. The only thing is you have to use it in the right place. You can't use it to validate incoming data. You have to use it at time of use, which, like, when you go to make that dangerous request using that attacker controlled data, that's the place where you need the security control.
Yeah.
Am I boring you to death of all?
No, absolutely not. This is the look of a woman who's learning, okay? I'm learning. This is my learning face, okay? Yeah. This is fascinating. And this is why, I mean, I could never be a security engineer. I respect security engineers so much, but it's not a job that I could do. I don't think my arteries could handle it.
The stress.
The, like, oh no, did I forget to escape something? You know? Like, I don't know.
Well, the best version of this job, right, of being a security engineer is being a product security engineer.
Oh, okay.
And so at that point, like, you're building the frameworks and libraries that other developers rely on in order to get things right.
Mm-hmm.
So I think one of the hosts of this show is building something that's like an NPM wrapper.
Yeah, for us.
That's
yeah.
Perfect, right?
Yeah.
He totally, I know, and I've read a lot of his stuff.
Socket.
And, yeah. Like, that's genius, because then no one else has to think about it. Like, they're like, he did it. He nailed it, right? Like, I could just use his thing and never think about it again.
Well, it's funny you say that. So one of our listeners had a question. Josh Kramer had a question in our Slack channel, by the way. If you're not in Slack, what are you waiting for? Join our Slack community and changelog. Join the JS Party channel, because that's where the real fun's at, you know? So Josh Kramer asks, quote, with the proliferation of frameworks that protect you against common issues, and in parentheses, I'm specifically thinking of client frameworks and cross-site scripting sanitation, does that reduce the responsibility of the developer to think about security or just shift that responsibility elsewhere, right? I think it's a great question, and it kind of goes to the point that you just raised, so...
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, what is computing if not abstraction? You know, we don't understand every detail of how things are working under the hood. I'm not sitting around thinking about the opcodes on my processor. Like, I trust someone got that right. So I think, like, it's the same with security, where, you know, if you're using a library and you're using its render method and you're not doing anything exotic, you would expect that, like, you'd be protected in some way with putting data on the page. And I think, like, these libraries we're talking about, like Lit and React, I think they meet that challenge. Like, they do the right thing almost every time. Where it gets dicey is when you have a common path, right? Like, I want to put URLs on the page. That's very common on the web. And, like, where every single person who wants to put a URL on the page in both Lit and React has to know about that thing I just talked about validating URLs. I feel like that's surprising to people. You know, often you won't let somebody construct the entire URL. It'll be like a relative URL, or like you'll put something on the front of it. But anyway, I mean, people work with URLs. So, like, there's areas like that where, like, the developer is still left to get it right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I'm looking forward to better abstractions even there. You know, it'd be great to just even abstract that, right? Someday. So, yeah, we're only on, like, number two of this list. I don't know. This is going to be a 3-hour show. Do we need to, like, do a bathroom stretch break, everyone?
I think people could read the list, right? And they're developers. And so, like, they could totally look at it and consume it. That's the intent.
This is a Changelog news break. PageFind looks pretty cool. It's a fully static search library that aims to perform well on large sites while using as little of your user's bandwidth as possible and without hosting any infrastructure. It runs after your static site generator, like Hugo, 11D, Astro, etc., and generates a static search bundle to add to your built files. It then exposes a JavaScript search API that can be used anywhere on your site. Quote, the goal of PageFind is that websites with tens of thousands of pages should be searchable by someone in their browser while consuming as little bandwidth as possible. PageFind's search index is split into chunks so that searching in the browser only ever needs to load a small subset of the search index. PageFind can run a full-text search on a 10,000-page site with a total network payload under 300 kilobytes, including the PageFind library itself. For most sites, this will be closer to 100 kilobytes. End quote. I'd love to see a comparison, link me up if you know of one, but my guess is that this could easily replace Algolia on lots of open source docs and websites. One less service to depend on. Why not, right? You just heard one of our 5 top stories from Monday's Changelog News. Subscribe to the podcast to get all of the week's top stories and pop your email address in at changelog.com/news to also receive our free companion email with even more developer news worth your attention. Once again, that's changelog.com/news.
So I wanted to, you said something about how software engineers mostly get it right. But this is not how security teams look at the situation. What does that mean? Like, what's the difference?
Oh, I'm going to blow your mind here, Chris. Okay. So, like, how many people on your average security team do you think write code at all at work?
Are you asking me?
Yeah, just like your general feeling.
Zero.
Fair enough. I don't know which companies you've worked at, but yeah. I don't know if it's a condemnation to those companies.
I mean, I think they're writing more tooling code. They're writing more scripts and they're like, you know, checking, and it's like internal spyware for good, you know?
That's what they're writing. Totally. Like automations, right? Security automations. Yeah, I think that's generally true. I think there's...
I guess, what is a security team to you? Because, I mean, I'm thinking, okay, so if I'm thinking like a security team...
Wait,
like,
should I light a cigarette? Do we need like...
No. Like what kind of security team? I don't know. What are we talking about?
No, it's a good point. You know, it's like there's organizations within most organizations called the security organization or department. And within that, there's often people with job titles like security engineer. There might be a product security group that owns some of the features of the application. Like in a modern SaaS organization, like you might have some kind of security organization that has folks in it who are engineers, who are responsible for things like authentication and authorization. And they're building those solutions and providing them to the rest of the org. This isn't like super modern organizations where product security is taking like a foothold. I think what you're describing is like the security organization that's also doing corporate security and like talking to you about losing your laptop and those types of things, often those folks won't be writing a lot of code. So I think that when you talk about somebody like a CISO or somebody who's the leader of a security organization, all the people that work for them at the company, and this can be various types, including software engineers, including product security engineers, including corporate people who might do something with paperwork or lost laptops. Yeah, so those folks, they don't necessarily, because they only really get involved when there's a security incident and when there's a mistake made. And that's what they focus on at their conferences are, oh, there was a breach, oh, there was data loss, oh, there was this problem. And so you end up with this lens on the developer community of, oh, the people in the developer community are making mistakes. And I just have a different mindset there. I'm like, they are not making mistakes. Almost every time they don't make a mistake. And so like, if we want to contribute, we need to build things. Like we need to take responsibility and become product security engineers or, you know, integrate the organization and get things built or build libraries and frameworks, contribute back to them so that it's easier to do the right thing.
It definitely seems there can be a like an adversarial relationship between security and, product development or something, right?
Yeah, there's some natural tension there of, you know, and on the security side lately, we've been saying a lot of like, oh, we want to be the team of saying yes, or we want to be like the team of enablement. But the reality is like, if you're not jumping in and like actually writing code and getting things fixed and building secure defaults, yeah, what is your role? You're at that point, you're an outside critic, right? You're just looking at what they did and telling them like possibly the place where they did it wrong, or maybe you're running some tooling that finds some stuff. In a lot of cases, they're false positives. Maybe you're telling them about a bunch of CVEs and their dependencies. And they're just like, whatever, you know? So I think that like,
whatever.
Yeah. I think it's like, if you want to like make a contribution, you probably got to be working at the library framework level or building the security features into the product that your company offers.
Right. That makes sense. So we've talked, you've mentioned product security a bunch. So can we just kind of maybe round out your definition and also just what your experience has been working in this space?
Sure. Yeah. I think that like, the line between like your traditional application security team and a product security team is blurry. Sometimes this is like some of the same engineers, but where the work is different is an application security team is trying to address the security defects in all applications. And so they're not like in the nitty gritty of each implementation detail, like exactly what library or framework was chosen or like what linters were configured or like why or why not some strategy on server side rendering. Where a product security engineer would be present for those decisions and it might be making them. So if I was on a team like embedded as a product security engineer on a front end team that was building something with lit HTML, I would be responsible for those types of decisions, like making sure those linters get configured and making sure that the parts that are dangerous are being addressed by actually shipping PRs and writing code to make sure that like everybody else was protected. It's just like it's like being a specialist in the sense of like an accessibility expert, right? We have front end developers that are like, know all about accessibility or internationalization, or they know a lot about performance. It's just like another, security is really just another aspect of software quality. And so if you're a product security engineer, what you're doing is you're embedding with the teams, and then you're trying to add to that aspect of the software quality and make sure that the software that comes out of your team is more secure than it would have been if you weren't present on the team.
Yeah, no, that makes a ton of sense. You're kind of there to enforce and guide and shepherd on those aspects. And I really love the analogy that you used around accessibility, internationalization, because yeah, I agree. Those are also specialties that are where there's usually an advocate on the team or within the company or whatever. So yeah, absolutely. Great analogy. So I'm like determined to make it through this list, y'all. I don't know if we're going to have time to cover the node stuff. We might just have to invite you back to talk about that but sanitize and render HTML. We've covered a little bit of this already. I'll couple it with avoid direct DOM access. Can you talk about those? The fun stuff.
Sure. Yeah, so sanitizing and rendering HTML. So you've decided that you have attacker controlled content and you have it inside of some HTML as a string and you want to get it on the page. And this isn't that exotic of a use case. This happens often with things like, say I gave you like some text and you auto-linked it. Like you ran around inside of it and added like every place where I looked like I was mentioning a URL, you turn that into a clickable anchor tag. Now I have this thing and I want to put it on the page. And in this case, we were talking about React. So you're probably looking at something like dangerously set or HTML-y it. But you might not know, like, is the stuff in there dangerous? I just want to like make it clean. And so like in the Python world, we have like bleach. In the JavaScript world, we have something called DOM purify. So DOM purify is this like easy button of a function within a library where you just say like, oh yeah, I want to like use DOM purify. And then I just want to call it on my stuff. And whatever comes out is now going to be safe for the context I plan on placing it in, which is I'm going to place this into the page as HTML content. And so under the hood, DOM purify is doing some work. And what the implementation of DOM purify, what it's actually doing is it's creating an HTML template tag. And then it's using an allow list based approach of known safe elements and known safe attributes that can be added to that template. And then after it gets done, taking your attacker controlled HTML and turning it into a nice template element made out of DOM nodes, it will actually take that, and this is where the scary part is, turns it back into text, and then has you put that into the inner HTML using dangerously set inner HTML. So I don't know if you caught it there, what the problem is. So DOM purify, if you look at its track record as a security mechanism, it often has bypasses. It's like, you know, you'll have a version that's working great and it's like escaping everything. And then someone out there will figure out, oh, you know, if you put like single tick and then back quote and then you do this, like,
oh yeah, it's a moving target. So is DOM purify something that Google maintains, or what's the one that Google maintains that's like always like, it's like the gold standard, you know, sanitization library.
There's been a few at different times. DOM purify is like probably the most popular library that's used for this purpose.
Okay.
I think like the caveat there is like, if you're going to do something dangerous and you're going to use a library like that, you just got to make sure it's up to date. I think I heard that like under the hood that Lit is doing something similar with building templates and then using those templates to create HTML content. I haven't looked at the mechanism for how they do that, whether it's like a direct translation where they're grabbing like, you know, an abstract syntax tree, or they're literally walking DOM nodes and recreating them, or whether they're taking the template and turning it back into a string. I doubt they're turning it back into a string. But if they were, that same vulnerability that's in DOM purify, that kind of intrinsic design flaw would also exist there. Yeah, but yeah, I guess it's, there's no easy button when it comes to that process. If you use DOM purify, great, just keep it up to date because potentially there'll be a bypass.
Yeah, and I wish this was a thing. Somebody please make it. Like, I feel like there should be a way to kind of like have a category of packages in your package.json where you're like, always keep this up to date. I mean, you could remove some, maybe it's a, you can use like the caret and whatever to like, but like even that isn't good enough, I feel like, you know, because developers can ignore that, you know. So maybe just a renovate set, you know, you can use a renovate or whatever, but like, how do you like force an upgrade basically, you know? Like that would be cool.
Yeah, I know that some of the folks, I remember when someone at NPM on the website shipped the feature where you could see the distribution of downloads. Mm-hmm. So you can look at a project like DOM purify and you can look at like over the last month, who's been downloading which versions.
Mm.
And so that there you can actually see the attack surface of that library in the wild, because you can see like, oh, look at the old versions. Those are the ones that are still potentially vulnerable.
Darn it, man. Yeah, see, this is why I couldn't be a security engineer. It's like, just, I always feel like I'm on.
It's all depressing, right?
Yeah. Don't... I mean, and I'm, you know, easily depressed, I guess. I don't know. Like, I've like just like, well, just my mojo is just like, oh, you know.
I think the way that you sell the Dawn Purify solution is like, you don't say all the stuff I just said. You don't say the thing about it. You just say like, use Dawn Purify, and that's like the end of the sentence.
Yeah, and just, you know, jazz hands.
So that's,
you know,
that's the funner way to do it. Like, hey, I got this great way to do it. I don't feel super comfy when I look at a code base and there's a lot of Dawn Purify usage. It kind of feels like, oh, we're doing this a lot. We probably need like a programmatic way to do this correctly using the React APIs or LitHP APIs.
Yeah, absolutely. So number five on your list is secure server-side rendering. So there is insecure server-side rendering, I guess, given that you use the word secure.
Yeah, think about this scenario. Like, okay, I'm on the server. I'm doing a bunch of stuff. I'm building an element tree. I got it in, you know, whatever framework I'm using, like React. And then I'm going to be outputting that as a string and then sending it to the client for hydration. Well, What if like when I have that render, I run that render to string method, what if I like had some other stuff I wanted to include on the page? And so maybe like, I don't know, I have some extra like analytics tokens or some other, you know, string-based HTML, concatenating that onto the end of the output, that's what gets rendered in the browser. That content has to also be, you know, you have to make sure it doesn't contain any attacker controlled content. So if you're going to take the output of something like a secure library like React, it's done all this work to render things correctly, you don't want to then append to that something dangerous using string concatenation.
I see. That makes sense. So it's like, yeah, don't bring a friend to the party, basically, right?
So, totally.
Got it. Okay, so check for known vulnerabilities.
I think we got
and dependencies. So we talked about that a bit. Sorry. So avoid JSON injection attacks.
You know, when I wrote this cheat sheet, I never thought that Amal, that you'd be reading it to me and having me go through it with you. This is check that off the list for life accomplishments.
Aw, dreams, you know, can come true, Ron, you know?
Right? So I guess what I'm talking about here is there's a common pattern where you've got some state, like this was written around the time that Redux was very popular. I don't know if it still is, but you'd often want to say like, oh, I have some state from Redux, and I want to put that like in a script tag at the top of the page. And then when React loads, it's going to like have that stuff in context, so it can just grab the initial Redux content and then it can, you know, get our state up and running. Well, often what's in that state is like cached values from previous application state. And so if you take attacker controlled content from previous application state and you concatenate it into a web page, it can escape out of whatever context it's in. So like if it's in a JSON context, it could just use like quotes to get back into HTML page context and introduce scripts to the page. So what you want to do instead is you want to run a serializer over your JSON. And make sure that like all the values inside your JSON are textually escaped for the JSON context, and they don't have any characters in there that can be used to escape out of that context.
Wow. See, I would have thought that would be redundant. I would be like, why would I need to serialize JSON? It's already serialized. But it's like, no. Like, you know,
the values themselves, right? It's about where you're putting it, right? So if you have a block of JSON as a, like just the text that defines a JSON object, and you're planning to put that on in an HTML tag as part of a document that you're planning to send to the browser, that's really the problem, because the browser doesn't know what you're up to. It just knows like, hey, you're sending me some text. And in that text, it looks like you defined an HTML tag. Then you started talking about a JSON object. And then all of a sudden you escaped out of the JSON object and you started just writing regular old JavaScript. And you know how browsers are. They don't like error and throw up a web page that says like, oh, can't render. It just tries to do the right thing. So it's like, I think I know what you want me to do. You want me to like read the cookie and send it to the attack controlled domain or something, which is like, what? It just goes ahead and does that, you know?
You're right. Oh, gosh. All right. So, and then we use non-vulnerable versions of React. We talked about this already. Just keep your packages up to date, people. Like, you know, just try to keep things moving. I know it's really, really hard in the JavaScript ecosystem because there's this little gnarly thing called, oh, I don't know, peer dependencies. And the peer dependency matrix is like living hell on earth. And it's like kind of getting worse. And, you know, you see a lot of like this TypeScript kerfuffle going on where people are just like, TypeScript, I'm throwing you out, you know? I think that's like some fatigue around having to maintain and keep this matrix in check, right? So anywho, so keep your stuff up to date. And this one's really important. Number nine, use linter configurations, you know? And so this is like a super low hanging fruit. And can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah. I think that like there's great ESLint libraries for React. And within like those basic ESLint libraries for React, there are rules that like help you avoid some of the mistakes we've been talking about.
or at least flag it so that you can pay proper attention to it. And I think the same is becoming true with Lit. So if you're using that, I'm sure there's a... So just go out there and try to find your framework relevant linter package and then look through the rules. Like some of them have a security related context.
Nice. Yeah, that's awesome. And the one that you point out is ESLint has a React security config. That's one example. And so how much of that is a moving target, Ron, where like you need to keep that updated? Like I'm curious, like are the linting, is it fairly static in the linting world or is it also a moving target where you really want to make sure that's always up to date?
Yeah, I think once you have a set of rules that you're happy with, then you're good to go. What I've noticed is like as like when you work at a commercial company like I do and we have reports coming in through Bug Bounty, like that's one of the first things we look for is like, oh, we made this mistake here in the code base. I bet it has like friends that are written in a similar way. Let's try to find a linter rule that meets this need. And then maybe we can apply that linter rule to all projects and catch like all instances of this going forward. It's a version of like just-in-time developer training as well, where like developers might not even be aware that some pattern they're using in code could potentially lead to a security defect or bug. And so, yeah, like just helping them get those linters turned on when you do find a bug.
That makes sense. Yeah. And you just brought up an important topic about reporting, which we're going to get into in just a second. So, and the last thing was this obvious, we talked about this a bunch already, but it was number 10, avoid dangerous library code, things like dangerously set inner HTML and all these other unsafe kind of properties, like just find a more programmatic way to do them. Like I loved your suggestion earlier of like, you know, if you're really doing this a lot and you have a need for this, like have an API return text to you or whatever it is, right? Like handle this in a more secure handshake, I really loved. So we got through your cheat sheet, yay. Yeah, 70 minutes later. One of our listeners had a really great question, which relates to something that you just said. His name is Thomas Eckhart, and he posted this in Slack, so I'm gonna read it verbatim. For applications, I've wondered before if there are people you can hire to evaluate your running application for common flaws. I try to be careful about dependencies. I read up on CEVs. I feel like the greatest threat to security of my application is me. And I plus one on that for Thomas. Like, I would agree. And so can you hire people to just like poke holes in your code and give you a report?
For sure. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of tools in this space, commercial tools and open source tools, where I think the categories that you might think about here are like static analysis tools. So tools that look at the code as it was written and try to like discern whether or not there's a security mistake. Linters would be the most lightweight version of this, but there's full-on static analysis suites that will take your application and do source to sync analysis and try to figure out if you have vulnerabilities. They generate a lot of false positives and they're often run by security consultants, the commercial ones especially, because they just have a high signal to noise. It's high on the noise, low on the signal. So developers don't often want to be the audience who runs those. But yeah, there's static analysis tools. There's something called dynamic analysis, which like I think Bug Bounty is the most common version of that. You've got some buddy who's like looking at your running application and trying to poke at it and say like, oh, if I like give this input, I get this response kind of thing. There's also automated versions of that. Like OWASP Zap is an automated DAS tool that you could run against your running application. It'll tell you if you have vulnerabilities. Again, you're going to get a lot of false positives, but if you're interested, definitely worth running. Of course, you could hire consultants to do this type of work if you have money, and companies hire employees to do this type of work. It's a whole function called red teaming within companies. There's offensive security engineers that get hired, and they spend their days looking at applications from like either like totally unknown to them applications where they don't have any special knowledge, or they'll know the application well, and then they'll still try to do an exercise where they attempt to compromise the security application.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I would say like, you know, if you're talking to your manager or your tech lead or you are a manager or tech lead or whatever, if you're in a position to advocate for this kind of thing, I would say totally worth it to have like a real person come and poke holes at your code. But on the other side, I would say it's also really worth it to get an accessibility audit done, right? So those are the two things I feel like are really like worth it for teams, especially once you have some traction for your app and it's being used by people in the wild. Like, yeah. Get an accessibility audit is, you know, even if your linter says you're perfect, like it never hurts to get feedback from someone, because with the accessibility auditors actually use people who are like who themselves use screen readers, right? Or and so that's like, you can't really replicate that with a linter. And then same thing for security. Like if you can get a person like to look at your code, like highly recommend it. And so we'll kind of like close off with this really important existential question, Ron, which is like, why are people not like taught about this, right? So like I feel like it's such an important thing, but like no one teaches developers on average like how to like secure their code or whatever. And I know you've made us all feel good about ourselves by saying like we get it right more often than we get it wrong. But I feel like there's still like fundamental things that we don't think about when we're programming.
It's a very interesting space. You know, I bought probably 20 books on secure coding in my life, and I would say more than half of them don't have any code inside of them, which is surprising. So the folks who are actually have been in this industry historically aren't necessarily like code level in their recommendations, surprisingly, for secure coding. So I think that like as the developer community becomes more aware of this problem space and wants to build more stuff in, like they have been to React and Lit and other frameworks, I think that like those security decisions and those secure coding patterns are going to be left to those folks who decide that this is a specialization they're interested in, and then they'll be building it in so that the rest of us benefit. I don't believe in a future where every developer figures all of this stuff I've been talking about like out and then applies it every day while they're at work, because that's just unrealistic. You can hear from me trying to talk about it. It's so nuanced, and like every case has caveats. So I think it's just an engineering like focus. And I think that, you know, they just haven't taught it historically because it hasn't been valued in the marketplace.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And I guess, you know, that's a great answer. And it really is nuanced. And it's a moving target. That's the other thing. It's nuanced and it's a moving target, which is why, like, if you have the budget, like, hire some security engineers, like, on your, you know, at your company, on your team. Like, it's, you know, if you have a sizable code base or a growing code base, like, this is, like, money well spent, right? So, because it really is a full-time job.
And I guess I would also say, like, if you're a security-minded person who's doing software development currently, you should check out product security roles, because at a lot of companies, that's a specialization that exists, and there are roles that are dedicated to this. And a lot of times, those product security teams will hire people who are just regular old software engineers, and then they'll let them focus on the software security aspects at work. I have a conference in Hawaii that we throw somewhat yearly, and the focus of that conference is just focused on product security. So we get together and talk about that.
What's the name of the conference, Ron, or is it a secret?
It's called the Locomoco Security Conference. The yeah. easiest way to find it is on Twitter. Yeah, we've had a lot of really good guests in the past come and talk about like various aspects of authentication, access control, how to get it right when it comes to content security policy, all these types of topics.
Nice. And you have a like you have another conference coming up in April, right?
Yes, we do.
Is this like the first one post-COVID?
I think we've had two since COVID. We had a virtual one, you know, we had to pull the trigger on the virtual. And then we had another one that we host them on different Hawaiian islands. So I think the last one was on Oahu. And we've had them on Kauai and the Big Island in the past. And the idea is just to get together with the small number of folks out there who are interested in this topic and have a lot of sessions where we can share like best practices. It's a single track conference, which is cool because then there's no hallway track. We're all kind of like locked into the same content. So it better be good.
Yeah. No, that's so cool. And then I had to ask this, but like JavaScript security versus real backend security. So we didn't have a time to really get into the node stuff. And I would love to have you back on the show to dig into this, maybe with some other folks from the node team as well. But, you know, can you talk about this a little bit? Because, you know, there's some number of things that you have to know for kind of securing your front end application code. But then your server is really, for me, where it gets like, I don't know. Honestly, servers are like, they're just like full, like they're like buggy state machines that are like, I feel like it's like you're always plugging holes, like in terms of like how to secure, like, you know, how to secure it. So I don't know.
Yeah, I guess I'm making some assumptions about the design of people's systems and just the organizations where I've worked or worked with. And I've noticed that there tends to be a microservice fleet somewhere of applications that are all talking to each other. They might not even be talking HTTP. They might be talking, you know, GRCP or some other intermediate language. And that fleet of services doesn't always have like the exact same security concerns as more of the forward-facing code. So I think if you come into a company like myself and you say like, hey, I know how to write JavaScript or TypeScript and I want to help with a security function, often what they'll point you towards is they'll say, oh, well, we have these front ends, which are things that are visible to people and they can interact with. The back end of the front end would be something that's like responsible for rendering, or maybe it's like some small services that intermediate conversations between the microservice fleet and those services that are running like out in the production web space. And so I think that like as a JavaScript security person, if you're thinking about like, well, where's the attack surface for me? It's not really those like deeply embedded microservices on the back end. Maybe a few companies use Node there. I'm sure they do. But like, I think like for the companies I've talked to, we tend to be more responsible for stuff that like ends up rendering a web page or ends up receiving data that came directly from a web client or a web API. And so just knowing like those types of problems are where you need to focus.
So we have like OWASP Zap, which is a tool to automate like dynamic checks of web app security, right? But I'm thinking, so if there's a tool that would do the same thing except for the backend. Now, it seems to me that that sort of thing may or may not care if it's written in Node or Go or anything like that. And we're just kind of checking, you know, maybe we're looking to see, all right, are they running, I mean, people have been doing this for years. Are we running like Nginx? Are we running Apache? Like what's serving up the backend and any known, you know, exploits?
Yeah. Like, yeah, no, I've given some trainings on this. Like I don't know if I can talk about this on a JavaScript podcast, but I've given trainings on like
anything
Golang.
Goes, Ron. Okay. JavaScript is the universal solvent. Yeah. Okay. I established that a few episodes ago. So yeah.
Outside of organizations where they run Node exclusively, people do, you know, on the back end, they might write their microservices in Go or Python. And I've worked with those teams. And I guess what I'm saying is like, it's just a different set of problems. Like you might be worried about things like, oh, I have like, I don't know, command injection vulnerabilities, or like I have data store injection vulnerabilities in SQL or whatever the data store layer is, MongoDB injection. You might have a lot of the flaws in those microservice fleets are related to too much trust between microservices. So kind of all the microservices end up believing whatever they're told by the other microservices in their request context without validating it. So they might say like, oh yeah, like I guess you must have permission to do this thing you're asking me to do, other microservice, because we're all back here on the back end and you've asked me to do it. And they might not check like access control, and they might not do a good job of like authenticating who's connecting to them. So a lot of the vulnerabilities on the back end are around like authentication, access control, injection of data stores. And then you have another whole problem space of business logic flaws, which is like, should this microservice or whatever even do the thing it's being asked to do? And sometimes it doesn't have all the context to know if it's supposed to be doing what it's being asked to do. So you have a bunch of logical checks inside of there. And that's when you get into conversations about, oh, you should have some kind of generalized access control, authentication, and authorization framework. Every single microservice shouldn't be responsible for like rolling their own version of access control and being like, if you're like this and if you're like that, then you could do this. It should be done in some centralized service, where they could say, hey, according to policy, I was just asked to do this, and I'm this type of thing, should I be doing this? And then they can find out from some centralized place where there's a policy, whether or not that particular thing is allowed by policy.
Yeah.
But yeah, not often like written in JavaScript, often written in other programming languages.
Yeah, yeah, no, that makes sense. And thank you for sharing that insight. We didn't have time to get into all the server-side stuff, and we'll, like I said, if Ron will agree to come back.
Yeah, the back end of the front end. We'll talk about Node.
Yeah, the back end of the front end, yes. Because remember, like, someone, actually Gleb Bahmatov, who's like one of my favorite people on Earth, said like, oh, you know, Mel, like, you really want to learn to get into security? He's like, just curl GitHub and just look at all the headers.
Yeah.
And like, go understand what each of those is doing, and you'll come back with a better understanding of what the hell like is security. And I that was like almost a decade ago. I don't even remember when he told me that, but it was like it was so enlightening to me, because I learned about that cool content, that security policy that's like, you know what I'm talking about, right? Where it's like, you can only run code from these origins, or you can only run code from the same origin, which I thought was like such an easy thing to like...
You might be thinking of like content security policy.
Yes, it is.
Which it's a monster of a header at this point. I think we're on content security policy version 3. There's a whole bunch of really cool stuff you could do in there, and you can get really nuanced about like what's allowed to run on the page, you know, where can it come from? Well,
exactly.
Yeah. Content security policies. Yeah. I think GitHub has a really good content security policy. The folks who wrote it did a really good job. And it starts with kind of like a deny by default approach, where it's like, by default, you can't do anything. And then let me tell you what you can do. Content security policies in the real world don't typically end up that way. They kind of end up like, hey, let's write a policy that kind of outlines everything we're already doing. Like, you're allowed to embed from YouTube, and you can do this from Vimeo, and you can do this from this place. And those ones are a little more leaky and easy to bypass. But yeah, if you can build a strong content security policy that explains like, all of our scripts come from this page, none of them come from the page contents itself. They all come from this external domain that we've defined. And so don't execute anything on the page that you end up finding unless it follows this policy. Yeah, that's, I think I quickly mentioned that earlier, that like content security policy is something you want as a defense in depth layer, because you're not always going to get it right when it comes to escaping.
So yeah, with that said, Ron, I mean, so where can people connect with you? Where can people learn about your courses and like all the things and just, yeah, like.
Yeah, I'm just Ron Paris, R-O-N-P-E-R-R-I-S on Twitter. You can find me there and talk to me. My conference, you can come there and meet me in person and we can hang out in Hawaii. Sure.
Yeah. And are your classes, I know you still had some courses, are those still on the interwebs?
I could probably dig up some links, but I think my focus has mostly been on, you know, at Reddit and trying to secure those five front ends.
Yes. That's true. Oh yeah. All those five front ends, right. which means that, yeah, it's signal to like let you get back to work. So it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show today. You really took us to school, and we'll put lots of links in the show notes, everyone. It's been, just been so fun, so educational. We'll have you back to talk about the front end of the back end. And did I say that right?
Either way.
Back end of the front end. I mean, it depends on what layer you're using. You know, some people, Node is their only back end. And a lot of people, it's the middle, you know?
Sure.
Depends.
It does.
So we'll invite you back to talk about that. And so with that said, have an amazing everything. We have a really great show next week. So stay tuned for that as well. And with that said, have a great day, everybody. Cheers.
Next time on the pod, Mel and the gang sit down for a conversation with the Node Technical Steering Committee regarding the future of Node and also Node versus X, where X is competitor runtimes, not the cesspool we all swim in daily. Technically, that's next up, unless you're a Changelog Plus member. Next up for Plus people is a bonus segment right after this outro.
Changelog Plus, it's better.
Thanks once again to our partners, Fastly.com, Fly.io, and TypeSense.org, and to the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder for keeping the beats banging on all our pods. That's all for now, but we'll be back to party with you next week.